A few remarks to begin with. Jerry, I didn't understand those quotations and phrases that you just read in context, let alone out of context. But two possible great books, bestsellers, came out of our discussion today. One by Neil Ferguson, which will bear the title, Bob Rubin, He Was Expendable. The other by Bill Kristol, Iraq, What's All the Fuss? This will give you a flavor of the depth of our intellectual exchanges today. Actually, the discussion was terrific. And I'm not surprised that people took it so seriously, because you have, as director of the Miller operation at the University of Virginia, one of the finest, one of the best public servants and public minds in our country. And he's going to do great things with the Miller Center. Now, this all comes out of your time, Jerry. I don't get the cane for 12 minutes. This is literally the first time I've attended a foreign policy conference in at least 7 years. I've boycotted them. And when I got the invitation from you all, Jerry, I thought long and hard about breaking this, but it had become a hard and fast rule for me. And I decided to do it for a reason I'd like to share with you, because to me, it's at the center of things for Americans like ourselves. Iraq is a tremendous event in our history. Our public servants, our leaders, don't have a good answer for what to do. And they're very far from united, which is what they have to be in order to have any chance of making the hard decisions that lie ahead. Iraq has destroyed one presidency, the presidency of George W. Bush, and we don't want it to destroy a second. There's so much to do in this country, so many important things that we must tend to, that people like ourselves have to dedicate ourselves to coming up with a viable policy. Now, I say the candidates, and I include every one of them in this, Democrat and Republican, don't have the answer. And they're not even close to the answer. Because basically, and sadly, I think they're almost all playing politics with what to do. Democrats on their side, the Republicans on their side. For us, it is a policy dilemma that is incredibly difficult to solve. We could solve it, it would be one thing. We could go to a candidate and say, here's what you can do. But we haven't done that ourselves. We're failing in the mission as well. And our debate, it seems to me, is often more like a debate than a serious effort to come up with a joint and bipartisan problem-solving policy. Now, it is hard because, on the one side, I believe Iraq and the outcome in Iraq is vital to American national interests. This is not a game, a joke, a simple mistake. It is a major commitment by the United States of America in an incredibly important and dangerous part of the world, part of the world that ties directly into the fate of our economy and security. This is not a hello and we're out of there in a year issue. It's a vital national interest. On the other side, Iraq is not a matter of staying the course. Staying the course isn't going to solve that problem. We can wish and hope, and I do wish and hope, come September and October, that there is a real change for the positive. But I would bet my substantial life savings against it. I don't think there's much of a chance. Even if it works in Baghdad, and it might, once the troops begin to recede, and they will, we're going to more or less go back to where we were before. This is an insurgency and a civil war and a terrorist war of enormous complication that can be resolved only by means of a political settlement. And we're very far from a political settlement. But I'd like to put on the table for your consideration tonight, and it really is done in that spirit, is an idea that might form the basis of a bipartisan policy. And again, I insist that no president will make the kind of tough decisions necessary on Iraq unless there is bipartisan support. We have to share the blame, share the responsibility, share the tough decisions. That's just the way it's going to be. Otherwise, they won't get made. I call this idea strategic diplomacy. And its essence is to figure out a way of beginning to withdraw without losing. Beginning to withdraw in a way that reinforces America's power in the area, that gives us a chance to settle some critical issues in Iraq and elsewhere on terms favorable to the United States. And my model for this is what President Nixon and Henry Kissinger did in Vietnam. Now, hear me out on this, because I think some people's memories about what happened are faulty. And it's important to get it right, because what they did, I think, may have some important clues for us on what we can do now. Nixon and Kissinger, and almost every foreign policy expert I knew, believed that when Vietnam fell, that it would lead to the falling of our friends as other dominoes throughout Asia, that it would set off this kind of chain reaction. Both Nixon and Kissinger referred to the effect on the United States' credibility and power in the world by saying it would make us into a pitiful, helpless giant. So almost everyone thought the effect would be dire. Now, mind you, at this point, we were out of Vietnam. Congress, unfortunately, and I think stupidly, cut off military aid to the Saigon government. But still, the Saigon government had 1.5 million men. 1.5 million men under arms, and it was well armed. Even as Nixon and Kissinger were saying the dominoes would fall, they began to make preparations to ensure that that would never happen. Even as they predicted the worst, they were trying to figure out how to get the best. And their insight, their strategic insight, was based on this simple fact: that the nations of Asia did not want China to win as a result of an American loss in Vietnam. In fact, they began to realize, as that moment was arising, that they needed the United States more than ever. And so what Nixon and Kissinger figured out was to return their desire with a diplomatic embrace. And they did it worldwide. In Asia itself, they reaffirmed American commitments to all those countries. They provided some additional military aid. We showed off our American military presence. We made clear in speech after speech we were prepared to stay there. We were going to continue to be a critical factor in Asia's future. At the same time, they had already begun triangular diplomacy. China was the emerging power in Asia. And they gave the United States the leverage point between China and the Soviet Union. There was a triangle. We were at the apex of that triangle. We were the one playing one side off against the other. It was global diplomacy on a grand scale for the whole world to see that the United States alone could play that role. We alone had that kind of power and position. Finally, they had put together an agreement between the Egyptians and the Israelis. Very complicated, finely choreographed series of maneuvers. But they brought together two countries that had just tried to kill each other, brought about a Sinai withdrawal agreement and set the basis for a peace between Egypt and Israel, which lasts till this day. It's not a happy peace, but it's a peace. And you had this diplomatic panorama where they showed that the United States was the only country that could do it. The United States alone had the diplomatic power to trigger common interests. They knew that we would suffer in credibility from losing in Vietnam, and of course we did. But they knew how to turn disaster into victory, and it was victory. 3 to 5 years after the helicopters lifted U.S. troops from the rooftops of our embassy in Saigon, one of the worst moments in American history. 3 to 5 years after that, the United States' position in Asia was stronger than it had been any time since the end of World War II. You won't find an Asian expert who disagrees with that. That's how far they had taken it. They saw other countries needed us. They saw other countries understood we were the only ones able to get certain things done. And that became the basis of our diplomatic power. I think we can apply the same logic in the Gulf and the Middle East today, although it's more difficult. The United States, not Iran, it's like the United States, not China, remains the major power in that part of the world. It's fashionable at the moment for foreign policy experts and even some people in the administration to talk about Iran being the power of the future there, the power that's making waves. That's nonsense. Iran is a 10th-rate country. Its economy is the size of Connecticut. The United States has the military capability with just the 2 aircraft carrier task forces sitting in the Indian Ocean to destroy literally every single target, economic and military, of value in Iran without one U.S. soldier stepping foot in that country. Just those 2 carrier task forces. And there's great division within Iran today, political division. A lot of the people who live up north aren't Persians, and there's great dissatisfaction between them and the government in Tehran. And besides, even with the Persian Shia Iraqis in the south, they don't like this government either. When they held an election only a year ago, Ahmadinejad's party lost. He had a free election in Iran. The government barred most of the opposition candidates from running, and they still won. Just to give you a measure of the political opposition. There is a country we can best. Their power in this part of the world doesn't come from their inherent economic and military strength. It derives from the mistakes we're making. We're giving them that power. It's like during the Cold War. Remember, in 1960, Kennedy said there was a missile gap. He said the Russians have gained superiority in long-range nuclear missiles. Well, there was a missile gap in 1960. There was a missile gap. We had 1,700 long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the Russians had 67. Khrushchev never corrected the record. Not once. He never said, oh, wait a second. Sir, you made a mistake. We only have 67. You have 79. He said, yes, and we'll bury you. We gave them free power, and they took it. We're giving the power to the Iranians. They're taking it. But they don't have the inherent strength or the allies. Now, how do we begin to trigger this? I think the paradox is we begin to trigger our power and the common interest by beginning a process of withdrawal. Now, I say beginning because I don't know when it will end. It's not going to be Korea. We're not going to be there for 40 years. But it will be much longer than any politician would dare to say. Once you become president, that president will realize. But you begin the process of withdrawal. And it can't be done the way the Baker-Hamilton Commission talked about it. Namely, we withdraw all the combat troops and leave just the logistics. That's ridiculous. Combat troops have to stay there to protect the logistical troops and to do other things. So the process has to begin. It has to begin because as long as they are convinced, the Iraqis are convinced, and they are, that whatever we say, our intention is long-term occupation of that country, we can't begin to trigger the common interest. So we have to begin to demonstrate to them we're moving out. And the withdrawal does that. Now, here are two things I believe would happen once the withdrawals begin. First, in the center of the country is with the Sunnis. The Sunni Baathist and tribal chieftains have been allied, for the most part, with the jihadis and the terrorists against us. Once we show that we're exiting, they're going to have much more in common with us against the jihadis. They plain will. The jihadis are religious fanatics. Most of the Sunnis who live in the center of that country are secular. And the jihadis are destroying their homes, their lives. We can help the former Baptists and the tribal chieftains in what will become their war against the jihadis. And they'll do a better job of killing the terrorists and neutralizing the terrorists than we will. They'll take care of the core problem we have there, terrorists gaining a foothold. In the south, with the Shia, the withdrawals also will trigger some important common interests. These Shia in Iraq have been the slaves of their country forever. They are not about to become the slaves of Iran. They want to run their own place. They are Arab Shia. In Tehran, they are Persian Shia. There's a big difference. The tradition among Persian Shia is theology plays a central role in government. The tradition among most Iraqi Shia is that that theology should inform the morality of political life, but religious people should not be in government. We can help the Shia of the South maintain their independence, which is what they're going to want most of all once we begin the withdrawal process. And that will take care, in large part, of our fears about Iran coming into Iraq and establishing a base in. The Shia themselves of Iraq really don't want this. Most of them don't want it. Now, in addition, it would be terrific if we could form some sort of agreement among the Iraqis, push them toward an agreement on a federal system to buttress all this. One with a limited government in Baghdad and with powers, main powers, being devolved to the different regions. But I don't know if you can have that anymore. It may happen by default. It's better to happen by negotiation. By default in war, it's better to happen by negotiations. Now, as we're doing this in Iraq, we begin to restore ourselves in the rest of the area as well. And we can begin to have a more sensible policy on the other critical issues. take the Arab-Israeli question. Right now, all the pressure is on us, especially because things aren't going well in Iraq, to hurry up a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that is inconceivable. All we can do is fail. And we're kind of being pushed and pushing ourselves to fail. There's no political groundwork that's been established either in Israel or among the Palestinians for a deal. If we restored Arab confidence in us, because of what we're doing in Iraq, we could step back and begin the longer-term process of rebuilding a consensus in that part of the world for an Arab-Israeli deal, rather than ensuring failure. As far as Syria is concerned, we have some very tough decisions to make. But the Syrians right now think that we may be part of the past because they think we don't know what we're doing. We and the Israelis in particular are going to have to decide what kind of future we want to try with the Syrians, what we want to gamble on. Do the Israelis want to gamble on giving back the Golan Heights? Do they think that they could survive the security risk? Do they think it would give them a good leg up to a political settlement? But that question would become live and reasonable for them to decide upon with our involvement as well. It has to be their decision. In Lebanon, the only way to establish any stability there is for us and the Israelis to make a deal with the Syrians. The Syrians can stabilize that country or not. It's as simple as that. What about the larger nuclear question with Iran? As I said, I think Iran is a country in deep trouble. The more we threaten it, the more we give speeches like the one Vice President Cheney gave, warning them about all the damage we can do to their society, the more we bring them together, not drive them apart. Right now, they're driving themselves apart. They unify when we present a threat to them. What we need to do is begin the process of talking to them without any illusion. It's going to be a long, hard, difficult process. It's always difficult for Americans to get involved in that kind of diplomacy because there's always more pressure on us than on the bad guys to compromise. But we have to know that. The president has to prepare the public so that we can withstand that kind of pressure and begin the process of energizing all those groups within Iran, and they represent the majority of that country, who want to improve relations with us and who know we hold keys to their future. Now, just to come back to where I started. The United States is a great power. Just as the nations of Asia needed to embrace us rather than to see a Chinese victory, the Arab nations need to embrace us in order to avoid an Iranian victory. We have to find some way of asserting that strategic power and restoring the American position in that part of the world. It's the only way to give the next president a chance to get out of this hole for himself or herself, for our country, and for the people of that part of the world. Thank you very much.
Will we time for some questions? He has knocked the microphone, so if you would ask your question as loudly as you can, we'll ask less to record.
Please. I enjoyed your speech very much. I'm not totally persuaded by your parallel with Vietnam. Does your argument imply that the president will have to go to Tehran the way Nixon had to go to China? So which presidential candidate can you imagine pulling this off most convincingly?
Well, did you hear the question?
Repeat it.
Well, it was rather long. Now, it's a very, very interesting question. Saying, if I think there's really parallel between Vietnam and Iran, is this going to involve doing what Nixon did with China, namely American president going to Iran to kick off this process? And if so, which of the thousands of people running for president of the United States might be best qualified to pull this off? You know, actually I would do it. I would offer it. Because I think that's a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. That right now, when we stiff-arm them for negotiations, that doesn't show American strength. That shows that we're fearful of these talks. So I would be bold. I wouldn't do it out of the blue, because I wouldn't want any embarrassment of our president. So we'd have to be prepared. But a dramatic move like that, I think, would affect internal Iranian politics, which is what foreign policy is all about. That's what serious foreign policy is all about. It's how you can use what your resources are, what you say and do, to affect the internal politics and decision-making in another country. And I think it would have a positive effect for us. Now, which of the cast of thousands could do it best? You know, it's interesting how few of these candidates, and we have plenty to choose from, really has much international experience. The only one with any international experience is Bill Richardson, and I don't think he has a chance of being elected. Pardon?
Jail.
Yeah, as a prisoner of war. But there isn't that much international experience. Look, I think that the key, as always, is not just the person in the White House, but who the advisory team will be, who they will bring with them. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, except for somebody like Dick Holbrooke, I think the bench is pretty weak on both sides. But I think somebody like Dick Holbrooke could pull it off.
Please. I'm going to preface my statement by saying that Les and I worked in the Pentagon together back in the 60s with Robert McNamara. When he was doing the Pentagon papers, I can recall his coming around and asking me about Indonesia, which was my big country at the time. Les, I think you're too optimistic.
I am?
Yeah. I think you're too optimistic about Iraq, because you build a big assumption into that if we withdraw, all of these players are going to be much more interested in having our presence. But you could argue just as well that our withdrawal from Iraq is going to cause these countries to be going into complete chaos. In fact, you've argued yourself, that it'll divide into three pieces. But why would those be necessarily easy pieces? Well, wouldn't it be chaos?
Yeah, I can't answer all the points you raised. Take me too long, Don. But one, I'm not optimistic. I'm quite pessimistic. And I'm searching for a way of foreign policy community having some unity and maybe bringing that unity to the next president. Because I think that the decisions that have to be made will be so tough. And they do involve serious risks. And I'm talking about not withdrawing. If we just withdrew in a year or two, whatever it might be, then it would trigger the kind of reactions in the area you're talking about. As I said, I'm talking about a withdrawal process to be put in sync with the larger diplomatic strategy. And I'd make it fit the strategy rather than fit the domestic politics. But look, let's face facts.
Unless we do something like this to let off the steam here in the United States, the demands for almost instant withdrawal will be unstoppable. And then we will have the problems. That's my optimism. Yes, please.
We continue to hear that many of the people, the population in Iran, are a little unhappy with the clerical rule. Is there anything that this country can do to encourage that group to show rebellion to the rule of the mullahs? What actions could we take that would help that?
Yeah. The question is, I talked about opposition to the mullahs inside Iran. What could we do to stimulate that? In truth, as people who follow this know, we are providing some aid and some arms to the tribes in the north of Iran. It's very marginal. The Iranian government is aware of it. They don't like it at all. That's their tough. But it's all quite restrained. And that program should be continued without our talking about it, without us saying, oh, we retain the option to have regime change and all the rest of that stuff that just gets us in trouble. But we should retain the program because it gives them something to think about and something to worry about. And they are worried about it. But if we trigger this prematurely, we expose those people, and we don't strengthen our strategy. Yes, please.
Because you invoke Vietnam, I'm going to ask you about your magnificent book, The System Works.
Yeah.
So you've invoked the Vietnam-Iraq analogy. In the case of Iraq, is this the system that, with different personalities in it, but fundamentally, systemically, we were vulnerable to decisions that would leave us in this position such that you'd be disparaging the way that you are? Or is this an anomaly and a set of personalities where we go back to the system once we get past the
person? Right.
Did the system work?
It's a very good question. I wrote a piece with the guy who authored the System Work book with me two or three months ago for the Washington Post Outlook section, just on this question. And it was hard to figure out. But in the end, I'll tell you what conclusions we came to. In Vietnam, you know, it sounds goofy, but the system did work. We defined our objectives in Vietnam according to what we thought the threat there represented. We thought intelligence community, foreign policy community, for a long time, that Vietnam was the cockpit of the communist challenge to the United States and Asia. It was often referred to in classified documents as the Asian Berlin. So the objective from the Truman administration on, including John F. Kennedy, was to maintain a non-communist South Vietnam. And that was a deliberate decision looked at year after year. Now, it turned out in the end it was wrong. I believed it was right for most of my career. But it turned out it was wrong because it wasn't sort of the focal point of the communist monolith. We even knew it in the 50s of the Sino-Soviet split and the tensions between the Chinese and the Vietnamese, but it never played into policy. In fact, when I went to work in the Pentagon and I saw these CIA documents from the 1950s, I was startled. But they're nowhere in evidence in the discussions of the senior people. But we said, hey, the stakes are very high here. We have to prevent a non-communist South Vietnam. If we don't, the dominoes are going to fall. They looked at the situation, and much like in Iraq today, they figured it's unlikely we can win this. It's going to really, in the end, be up to the South Vietnamese to do it. We're not going to be able to win it. But we can't lose it either. So Johnson, Kennedy, all of them ended up making decisions to do the minimum necessary not to lose, knowing that if they did more, it wouldn't produce victory, but simply stalemate at a higher level. But they had figured it out that way. It turned out to be wrong. But the process was kind of a rational foreign policy making process. I was involved in it at the end of my stay at the Pentagon, very, very much so. But it was the same way. And it was the same way I stayed over with Mel Laird for 6 or 8 months, and it was the same way with him. and so how did they think it was going to end? They hoped something would turn up. That was the sort of least rational part of it, but they couldn't afford to lose, couldn't afford to get out, couldn't afford to lose, and couldn't win it. And they were praying that if they just held on, that something might happen. And if something didn't happen, at least they would hold on, and it would be up to the next guy to lose the war. You can draw your own parallels. Please?
Yeah, isn't one difference between the United States vis-a-vis China and the Soviets then, and vis-a-vis Iran and Sunni Arab states now, is that in the 60s, the United States didn't have much history of deep cooperation with either the Chinese or the Soviets. And so each could say, all right, well, the Americans aren't really pro-Soviet, they don't have this history, and the Soviets would say the same thing. But in contrast, the United States has a history of deep cooperation with the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Saudis more particularly.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to put the question I'm getting at is, why would Iran go for this? Why would Iran cooperate with the United States when they're convinced, ideologically and for reasons of history and interest, that the United States is the great savior?
Right.
And we're funding rebels, as you said. They also, and they have a close alliance with Syria, Hezbollah, and they really think they're going to have Iraq. So why would they go for this?
Did you all hear that? Because it's pretty long to repeat. Why should the Iranians go for it? This isn't like the Soviets and the Chinese, who didn't know where we really stood. The Iranians know where we really stand. Well, first of all, your characterization of what the Soviets and Chinese thought about us is inaccurate. We now have a considerable amount of information, particularly from the Soviets, but also from the Chinese, and the vast amount of material relating to Nixon and Kissinger and their reports on their meetings with them. In fact, the Soviets thought we were siding with the Chinese. The Chinese thought we were siding with the Soviets. And even though Nixon and Kissinger were pretty careful in what they said to them, that was the impression they started with. It was the impression they ended with. And Nixon and Kissinger never really tried to flat out dispel it either. Let them worry about it. Let them worry about it. But it was something in their heads rather than something that got in the way of policy. There wasn't much of a symmetry. In fact, there was very little agreement at that time. The agreements were odd. For example, the only agreement we made of substance with the Chinese at that point was they gave us access to their territory so we could put bases, intelligence bases, on their territory to monitor Soviet missile tests. And in turn, we agreed to sell them military equipment. It was a very concrete, specific deal. And with the Soviets, as you know, the main leverage was to be to get them to help us in Vietnam. And Nixon and Kissinger were at this all the time, and they never did. Soviets just never did. So it wasn't that triangular diplomacy produced great diplomatic results for us. It didn't. I think a lot of the conservative criticism of Nixon and Kissinger on that score was correct. There wasn't the results on that level. But there were tremendous results in terms of perceptions of American power and American standing. And that was very important, particularly after Vietnam. Please.
You didn't answer this question, which is a good one, which is, what does Iran get out of this deal?
Oh.
They have the United States on the ropes in Iran. What exactly, why are they going to do this? I can see why this makes sense for us.
Right. I thought I explained it there, but let me do it again. I probably did it too hastily in my talk. I think we can make our position in Iraq better. I think we can strengthen our position both with the Sunnis in the center and with the Shiites in the south. And once that happens, and I believe it would begin to happen and show quickly, the Iranians would lose a lot of their clout in Iraq. The fact is, there's nothing Iran has to give the Iraqis except cause trouble. There's nothing they can put on the table to really help them. We can. And I think it would trigger those common interests, as I said. That's how I think it might work. Now, look, we've had 4 years of misery in that country with very bad policy. It's very hard to dig ourselves out of the hole. What I'm talking about may well be a long shot. I don't know what the odds are. But you show me something else that offers a real chance of doing it. It always comes down to that. Look, I think of ideas all the time that I consider bad ideas, except for the other ideas I hear. That's why I say it's critical for people like us to iron it out on that basis. We owe it to our country to try to work this out, to put aside all these arguments that we're going to make, oh, you were a jerk, and you were too weak, and you're a traitor, and you're a cut-and-run guy. What kind of? That's not for us. That's for the politicians. We need to do better, and we need to do it on the basis of realizing that what we're going to come up with is not going to make the waters part. It will be the best available alternative. And all I'm saying is, here is the logic of how I think our power would play out. Please, sir.
On the 28th of May, there was supposed to be a training.
Could you talk a little louder?
On the 28th of May.
Yes.
We had a discussion at the ambassadorial level in Iraq, in Baghdad.
Right. You're talking between Iranian and American ambassadors.
Yes. Presumably broke the freeze of since 1980 of diplomatic relations between the two countries.
Yes.
Now, the question is whether our getting involved with Iran at whatever level is not compatible with encouraging reformers. Because as Iran sees it,
yes,
the regime, right? They see it very differently, that we are begging them. And this is the regime, the mullahs, mm-hmm. not the opposition. So are we, by doing so, instead of encouraging the reformers, we are encouraging the mullahs or the radicals mm-hmm. to believe that they are actually playing us.
Right. Yeah, did you hear the argument? This is the main argument against what I'm talking about in terms of Iran, that Iran will take this as a sign of weakness, that the mullahs are already saying that the U.S. is just begging for talks. That's how weak they are. Well, look, first of all, you and I don't know whether the mullahs believe they really think we're begging. They could be saying that. And my guess is they are just saying it, that they're playing into the growing perception of American weakness in the area, and they're feeding it with this line that the Americans are begging. I think the best way to overcome it is not for Dick Cheney to give a speech saying, hey, we got these carriers and they could knock the hell out of you, which unites them, including the opposition. But for us to show we're not afraid to negotiate, because we are the power in the area. We can put out these stories too. And ours are based on reality. We have the economic clout that Iran can only dream of. We have the ability to protect other countries in that area far more than they have to challenge them. And we have the capacity to bring about diplomatic solutions between adversaries in that part of the world where Iran has no clout whatsoever. Let's play to our strength. Let's show the people in the area once again that we are the major power, not Iran. And let the mullahs say we're begging.
But I bet the same people speak for you because...
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I said I respectfully disagree.
Please, sir.
That Iran does not have. They are most effective in the use of soft power.
In the use of?
Soft power.
Soft power?
Of trade.
Yeah.
Pilgrims, billions of dollars in power, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, to the point that the president of Afghanistan the other day praised Iran for its great help to that country. So they are not necessarily going in with military muscle, but they are doing what we are not doing, the use of soft power. They are indeed in great shape in relationship with both Iraqi elite, some of whom lived in Iran for 20 plus years, and also, the traffic is not so much arms as we see in the media, but it is in trade.
Well, let me ask you, I don't believe in soft power stuff, and economics is not soft power. But leave it aside. Are you saying because the Iranians have contacts in Iraq, and even good contacts, that we should do what?
No.
Well, what should we do about it?
No.
Should we say, oh, it's yours. You have nice soft power relations with them. Take the country.
The Iraqi elite, the help they are getting from Iraq.
What do you want to do about it?
I'm just saying, you mentioned that there is nothing really Iran is doing. I'm saying.
I didn't say there's nothing they're doing.
But not by.
I said, basically, they derive their power from our mistakes.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. Iran. Certainly, opportunity was what we did. We removed two enemies, Taliban and Saddam Hussein. Certainly, that was the biggest opportunity.
See, I think somebody who knows as much about it as you do, and you know more about it than I do, got to help figure out how to deal with the problem you raise as part of dealing with the business of beginning the withdrawal process and reasserting American strength in the area. I don't believe that any problem is unmanageable. You can deal with it somehow. You have to deal with it somehow, otherwise your policy will fail. So we need people like you helping to figure it out.
I agree with you because actually I'm more in favor of the discussion that has just begun.
Good.
Right? But all I was saying is that we also have to realize how the other side sees what we do.
I understand. But I don't know whether they're telling me what they really believe.
Yeah.
I mean, I dealt with the Soviets throughout the Cold War, and they were terrific at saying things to play into American politics or to European politics. And I most of the time, I didn't believe they believed it, but it was smart to say it anyway. Right. Yes, please.
What would you say to the accusation that you have the bias of a foreign policy expert?
You're right.
And that bias that you voice is that to every problem there is a solution. If only you are clever enough and you think hard enough and flexible enough. Now, Elliot Cohen wrote, and was now the counsel of the State Department, wrote an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal that probably led to his appointment, in which he outlined the seven possibilities we had in Iraq, given where we were, and pointed out that each of the seven leads to catastrophe. Now, he was chosen as counselor of the department. Now, what I wonder is whether you have the sort of bias that leads you to think, well, you know, if we think hard enough, even though these people don't have a rational decision-making process, either in Iraq or Iran, or indeed among many of the nationalists in the Middle East in general, we think hard enough and we can come up with a solution. Now, historians know that there are sometimes, there are some problems to which there is no solution. And I can think of interwar Europe where that happened a great deal. I mean, the problem of the Polish courage. But to just pick one that is very, will be obvious to all, it's what policy you could follow on the Allied side in early 1939. Now, no degree of hard thinking will lead you to a satisfactory solution. We know, for example, that the non-rational mullahs are building an atom bomb in Iran, that they already have missiles that can cover the entire Middle East, that they have no reason to give up the program they have. So if you can extrapolate, if you can jump out of your skin as a specialist in foreign policy who's supposed to give people answers,
yeah, let me.
What would you say to this accusation?
I would say to the accusation that you thoroughly misrepresented most of the things I said. I believe, starting at the beginning, I didn't say they all had solutions. As I said, has solutions or deal with it. And deal with it, you have to.
How would you deal with it?
And look, I would never hire anybody to be my counselor if I was Secretary of State who tells me all I have is no alternatives. I've got to do something. I've got to do something. I can't say, you know, Elliot Cohn figured out everything we do is a catastrophe, so we're closing the doors and going on vacation. Look, let's be reasonable. Of course, I don't mean a solution, and I didn't say satisfactory solution. Those are all your words, your extrapolation of what I said. I'm talking about an incredibly tough problem that we've got to find some way out of with our real power and with political unity in this country. It's no joke. And it's not a matter of gamesmanship. I can do the same thing Elliot Cohn does too. I could have given that talk. But we get nowhere with that, nowhere. It's to show you're academically clever. We've got to do more than that. We have a responsibility to help figure out something that a political leader can do. I enjoyed this very much tonight. Thank you.